Comments on Cerotech Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent Cerotech Corporation, its staff, management, third-party resellers, or sponsors.
Welcome to the latest Cerotech Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Cerotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft.
Welcome to Cerotech Tech Chat 100. We made it. It's May 5th, 2011, Cinco de Mayo, and tonight's topic is Microsoft Windows Q&A. And to celebrate our 100th Tech Chat and Cinco de Mayo, we are giving away one copy of Cerotech's DocuScan Plus for Windows and Mac. You can use it on either or both. Yes, cross-platform, what a concept. Now, I need to outline the rules here. Those viewing via Accessible Event should be able to see the document here. But what we had to do is to make sure that everyone is on an equal playing field. You must use Twitter to register to win. So you need only send us one question. If you send duplicates, we only look at your first entry. So don't do anything just yet. I need to tell you how we're going to do this here. But your question must be on the topic of Microsoft Windows. So hopefully there's something you've always wanted to know. We've got a great panel of guests here to answer whatever questions may be on your mind. But you ask your question via Twitter using the hashtag Cerotalk. So what that means is when you submit your question, you begin with number sign Cerotalk space and then your question. So that's what I call the hashtag. And then we monitor Cerotalk, and then anytime that's listed, it comes up for us to see. What we will do is I will shortly give you a number. And what that number means is our producer, Joe Steinkamp, will be monitoring via Twitter.com where everything updates in real time. And when that number of person entry comes up on the screen that's not a duplicate, they will be designated as the winner of the $299 DocuScan Plus for use on both Windows and the Mac. So, let's see here. We have a pre-selected number. Before I give that, let me give you just a little bit more information here before we go forward. First off, we know that some of you could not join us live. So for those of you who cannot be here live, we will give away another prize. It is not a copy of DocuScan Plus, but we will be giving away to someone catching the archive of this a $100 Cerotech gift card. It's good for $100 Cerotech software and services. We'll give the details for that later near the end of this event. Now let me introduce our guests. I'm calling them our experts. Joining us to answer questions this evening include, and I don't know if he got his audio worked out, so it may be that one cannot join us. Richard, have you been able to work out your audio there, sir?
I don't know. It may still be breaking up too much.
Okay. Yeah, it's better. It's still breaking up a little bit, so we'll keep you there, but hopefully work that out here. Joining us, Richard Wells. He's quality assurance for Cerotech Corporation. Make sure that all our software works as best as possible before going out to the masses. Also joining us, she was with us last week and got annihilated thanks to our folks at Skype, but Rachel Schroeder. Hello, hello.
Hi there.
Yeah.
Glad to be back. You gave me a second chance.
That's right.
I'm happy to be on the 100th episode. I'm a little late getting into this game, but glad to be here.
Yeah, I don't know your exact title, so you can correct me here. I'm just calling you Assistive Technology Trainer and Specialist working with the state of Illinois, iltech.org. Was that pretty good?
I'm an Assistive Technology Specialist working with Illinois Assistive Technology Program. I'm based in Springfield, and I travel around the state training people on all kinds of assistive technology, hardware, software, Windows, whatever they need for their job or school or whatever.
Very good. Also joining us, Corey Martin, who's based in Canada, and he's built many computers for an actual computer shop from scratch, both the hardware as well as installing Windows. Corey, thanks for joining us this evening, sir.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And our resident guru geek is also here, Mr. Peter Bosley, for anything our other experts can't get to. Pete is here to...
Is anyone tired of me yet?
If they are, they're not complaining to me publicly. Oh, but anyway, you may ask questions later via Accessible Event. Just keep in mind that questions submitted that way will not be eligible or registered to win the copy of DocuScan Plus, which is a $299 value for both the PC and Mac, but all questions are going through Twitter. I have come up with the lucky number, and again, Joe Steinkamp will be monitoring via Twitter.com, But the 21st question, question number 21, beginning now, the 21st post that asks a question, again, using the hashtag CeroTalk, it's a specific question about Microsoft Windows. There's something you've always wanted to know. Tonight is your chance to find out. We'll get to as many questions as possible. Now, while that's taking place, I guess we can say that just a couple rules here, that one entry per person. CeroTech staff, families, third-party resellers, and sponsors may not participate. Prizes may not be sold or transferred to another person. And the deadline for the $100 CeroTech gift card is 11:59 p.m. on May 11th. So, again, we'll give the instructions on how to register for that here shortly. But right now, it's DocuScan Plus, the 21st question that we get via the Twitter hashtag CeroTalk. We'll do the trick. While we're waiting for some of our first questions to come in, and our guests may look through those as well. And if you see anything there that's in your area of expertise, knowledge, you may certainly submit those as well. But I want to start with Rachel gave me a link here to Windows 7 eBooks via Google search. And I wanted to mention this because there was quite a few here. And Rachel, you found a pretty comprehensive document on Windows keyboard shortcuts. I will bring up that Word document here in just a bit. So you gave me this resource, and I guess it's been invaluable to you as a AT trainer to help get people up to speed, and maybe even yourself on some of the intricacies of Windows.
That's one of the first things people ask is, where can I just get a list of keystrokes? You know, they can write them down in their notes, but if you just want to look something up, it's kind of nice to have a comprehensive list of keystrokes. So that's one of the things that I direct a lot of people that I work with to. And it's been very helpful. I had one person actually emboss the whole thing out in Braille.
Yeah, many people like to do that. They certainly do. Okay, our first question asks, if the newest version of Google Chrome accessible on Windows. Pete, have you played with that?
If you're talking about the latest stable version, it should work with NVDA and System Access. I haven't played much with the development channels.
Right, so I know the version 11, which I guess what we call the stable version, has some voice to text. So it has built-in ability to use voice commands to navigate. I don't know if anyone's played with that. Corey, have you done anything in that space?
I tried it a little bit. It's seems pretty accurate, but not a lot. I mostly stick to Mozilla and IE, but actually Mozilla 3, but. It does seem to work, but you got to be careful, of course, of your audio. Can't have your speech conflicting with it too much.
Yeah, any voice that speech recognition, point. Exactly. You need a good microphone, good noise cancellation, preferably headset mic that's not picking up the speakers. And the same stuff applies in using built-in Windows 7 or Dragon, naturally speaking, right. All of those apps as well. Well, I wait for some more questions to roll in here. I've seen some folks want to wait, hoping they get 21. That doesn't mean when I get to 20, you start submitting your questions. But Joe is monitoring that. And I want to ask, I'm seeing a new trend where a lot of drop-down boxes are not working now with a lot of screen readers. Peter, they're using some new technology to do drop-downs or list boxes, or what do you think's happening? Is it ARIA, or what's going on?
What's happening is that they're using, in some websites, or in some cases that I've seen people reporting, they're using JavaScript to, as someone makes a selection in a drop-down box, they're assuming that once you've put focus on an item, that's the item you want to pick. So, as you use Alt-Down to move up and down the drop-down box, it's selecting that item and then sending that item back to the website, and oftentimes the page will refresh based on your selection. So in my opinion, it's poor website design more than anything else.
Yeah, a lot of folks are going to it. I'll let you comment, Rachel. I had to use four different screen readers just to buy a bus ticket on Greyhound, and then I can't even buy it for another person because there's a radio button that I can't alter. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, sometimes if you know the website well, you can kind of work around it. If you hit the first letter of what it is you're looking for, and it'll bypass that. And if you can be really quick every once in a while, if you just arrow down, say you know it's the third option down, you can arrow down really quickly before it has a chance to focus. Those are really hit and miss possibilities, but sometimes they do work.
Yeah, they're tough with things like state, some state drop downs right now. And yeah, you can hit the first letter, but you have to remember, how many I's do you hit for Illinois or Indiana So there's some...
It's just as annoying for sighted people, so I think that we'll see that design trend reverse once developers get screamed at enough.
Oh, I can only hope.
I've seen a couple of strange drop downs where you can actually press the space bar to open the drop down. It's a strange thing. Instead of an all down arrow, pressing the space bar opens.
Okay, using the space bar. I'll try that one, Richard. That's very interesting.
Actually, that is a mouse-activated drop-down, and they're not actually drop-downs in the sense that they're HTML drop-down boxes or form drop-down boxes, but especially in system access, pressing the space bar on an item that's focusable will cause the mouse to move to that location. So as the mouse hits that location, the web application will expand that selection area.
Okay, our next question, Goldheart asks, how many USB devices can Windows 7 handle at one time?
As many USB ports as you can get on your machine, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know of any limit, right? I mean,
there may be an upper limit. Like, I could research it and give you a finite answer. I'm sure there is one, but it would definitely be more than you could ever possibly even hook up, even with USB hubs and all kinds of stuff like that. It's not something you could ever foresee to run out of. I think my home desktop here has about 15 USB ports, and I can max them all out, no problem.
Is there any difference?
I think you would get to the practical.
Yeah, practical limitation, and any difference between 32 or 64-bit, or could there be a device conflict and just interrupts and things of that sort? I don't know. But we'll see. What are the questions?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
I think it's 256.
Okay. How Bizarre asks, how can Windows 7 defrag itself if programs are running?
So Windows 7 uses what's called volume shadow copy service, which is a feature of Windows 2003 and above. I think it was even in XP to some degree, that keeps an active copy of a file even if it's locked or opened. And the operating system will queue actions that they want to take on files, and later on, after the file is unlocked, will perform those actions. A lot of times the defrag procedure will ignore things that are open, though.
Yeah, I mean, you could even use software and do a whole full data backup, make an image of your Windows with it running. It's just obviously restoring where it has to go into safe mode. So, yeah, that was an issue in the old XP. Remember, we'd keep starting over at 1%, you get in this infinite loop. But now Windows 7, I think they've got that taken care of. Let's see our next question. Can you offer a brief overview of Windows Live? Wow, who wants to take that one?
I can take part of it if somebody will kind of back me up here. Basically, what Windows Live is, think of it kind of as a suite of programs. You've got email involved in that. You've got, that would be Windows Live Mail. You've got Windows Live Messenger. And I'm just drawing a blank on some of the other ones. But it's like a suite of programs that can be installed. And if you look in your start menu or your programs menu, every bit of the Windows Live stuff is going to be under that one menu. It's kind of like Microsoft Office, where if you go in that menu, you've got Microsoft Office, Word, PowerPoint, Excel, Outlook, that kind of thing. So I don't know if that's what you need, but if somebody needs to elaborate anymore, I don't know.
Windows Live also includes some features, Writer and Photo Manager, that aren't really accessible, but Live Messenger and Live Mail are really the ones that people use the most.
There's no voice chat built into that? Because there was in the old 2009.
Into Messenger there is.
Yeah, in Messenger itself. There's some voice chat. And it's strange. I've used it on some computers where no other voice chat technology would work, or it was more stable. So it's just interesting to play with different apps and get different results. Let's see. Robert Carter asks if anyone knows a way to access a Fox Pro database with speech. Well, we went quiet on that one.
Fox Pro is a weird thing, and it's probably something that you would have to look for some scripts for. Somebody might have something for Window Eyes or JAWS.
I'm wondering if the database could be converted also. You might try that as well. Now, if you have to access it through Fox Pro, you might be out of luck or need the scripts like he said. But if it's something that you can use and convert data back and forth, it might be best just to export it somehow.
Yeah, and I wonder,
Michael, did you focus a Google window? Something's showing up on AE.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I had to Google. Let me go back to that. Okay, I'll go back to that page and also clear the window shortcut keys. And our next question. Okay, now one question per person. We did have a question about accessible TV tuner cards, and so that is a popular topic. There's quite a few. Hupage. I don't know. There's a few different ones out there. It's a question of actually coming up with some software. I know Coat Factory is working on something to get into that space, something that's supposed to give you your whole channel lineup and record. And And of course, I use Beyond TV, which is a kind of a web-based way to approach it. And it costs about $69, and you know, your card's about $69. Of course, if you want to interface it with a PVR, some kind of cable box, it's another $69. So it can cost you about $200. So you either some folks are doing it within the thing built into Windows 7, the metal block here.
Center.
Yeah. Media Center is usable. It's I've used it. And I've used the HaPodge WinTV application. Certainly not probably on accessibility, but it's certainly enough that you can navigate the channels and program it and do those sorts of things. So it is usable. As for getting things like subtitles or anything like that, that's probably more where you need something like what Code Factory is doing. But as for using the basic applications, the Media Center is probably a good bet, honestly, because it does seem to work with, when I tried it and used it. And it's, again, probably not the most accessible thing, but certainly better than nothing.
If you have, some of your local cable companies will support this and some of them won't, but just last year, some of them started to let you actually get cable cards that would attach to your machine so that you could get some of the encrypted channels. So, and that worked fairly well, but back before I got rid of my cable.
Yeah, I mean, and the good thing about something like Media Center is you can use your TV card, but there's also online shows of CBS and I think NBC and some other networks, so you can kind of mix local TV channels, cable, what have you, with online shows as well. But you're right, a lot of people are going to Netflix, Hulu, and some other options for doing their TV. So, and it's making cable companies scramble and change their whole models. I think that's part of the reason for the bandwidth caps, personally.
Let's see. I would agree.
Coffee Brewer asks differences between, I don't really know, it's too early to tell, differences between Windows 7 and Windows 8. I mean, is 8 even at a point that we know?
It's nothing anybody that has any knowledge of can talk about. We'll put it that way.
There you go. Anyone who does is in a non-disclosure agreement and really can't talk. So we don't know as far as accessibility or really anything else. I did tweet an article the other day that went into more detail about what we might look for in Windows 8, but there's concerns about the ribbon being used for Windows Explorer and some funky things like that that we'll have to get used to.
Yeah, I've heard that's true for IE10 as well.
Yeah. Here's someone, Servant Warrior says, if I can get it here, had difficulty deleting a folder in Windows 7. The only solution was to disable UAC. Has anyone seen that? Is there a workaround to that?
UAC protects certain folders. It depends on where it was located. For example, if it was in program files or something like that, it'll be protected by UAC, and in which case, you may need to disable that or have administrative access and get UAC to grant you access to do that privilege.
If you disabled UAC to delete the folder and you were successful, you should go ahead and turn it back on.
Absolutely. No question about it.
How do you feel about lowering it to like 33%? Do you think it needs to be?
I think people should leave it at the default.
Yep. With system access, you definitely don't want to lower it to 33%. We have a quality issue there.
Okay. Let's see. We have a question. Using MS Office 2003 with Windows 7, should I upgrade? Do they need to upgrade?
I just recently tested that, and Office 2003 works great in Windows 7.
Yeah, the only thing
you
is...
You don't really need to upgrade if you're using just the standard stuff. The only thing you may want to do is get a file. It's downloadable off the web. That is a file conversion tool so that if somebody tool 2007, they all have a, like, for example, Microsoft Word documents. They're not .doc in 2007 and beyond. They're .docx. So you need to be able to get something that takes those .docx or .xlsx files to convert them down to 2003. So, but I don't see any major. And if you don't like the ribbon, yes, there are ways around it. But if you prefer the menu style and you don't really have any need to upgrade for any specific purpose, then 2003 is going to work fine for you.
In the case of Outlook, there's lots of reasons to stay with Office 2003.
Yeah.
Sorry,
go ahead, Gordon.
I was just going to say there is actually a conversion plugin that Microsoft offers for that, and it's free.
Right.
Just go to download.microsoft.com, and I believe they call it the Microsoft Office Compatibility Pack.
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, I'm just going to point out to everybody that Office 2003 hits end of support at the end of 2012, I believe it is. At that point, I would recommend everybody consider an upgrade because Microsoft will stop patching security vulnerabilities in those applications after it hits that period of time.
Okay, Kevin Chow has a question asking about what's more important for Windows accessibility, local applications or web-based? I'm paraphrasing that. Make sure I got the gist.
Well, web-based, of course, is going to be more accessible because unless they're using really wacky web elements, I mean, local applications are a lot more apt to be non-standard than web ones are.
Well, however, the trend is going toward a lot of web-based applications. Even Microsoft is wanting to try out some web-based stuff. So I see that as kind of being the trend of the future, where so much of that is going to be web-based rather than local applications anyway.
The GUI tools on Windows are in large part kind of scattered out there, unlike on the Apple side where there's only a few different UI design methods. So I think that we're seeing things head more towards web-based applications, but as far as native applications go, we still need to be paying attention to that sort of thing because a lot of things can't run in a web browser. Web browsers, by their nature, have to be sandboxed and isolated from certain things in the operating system to prevent all kinds of malfeasance.
Malfeasance. Whoa. Okay, let's see. This next question says, any idea of when Microsoft might develop standards for speech and magnification to work together?
No comment.
Probably
The people who can answer that question, again, are under NDA and wouldn't answer it at this point.
Right. So we will infer from that maybe something is going on in that space, but we're not to know yet. And if we were, they'd have to kill us. So, okay. How do you get good TV when you don't have cable? What extra do you need? Well, I mean, that's
Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix is really $7.99, all the movies and TV shows, although they don't have the current season in there. That seems to be the number one portal. And Hulu.
And guys, go out and pick up an Apple TV for $99, and Netflix talks on there.
Yeah, Apple TV is pretty cool.
Well, as long as
even on iOS devices, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have an HD TV, right, you can't interface it with the old school analog, right?
Yeah, no, you need an HDMI port, yeah.
Okay, so that's the key to – yeah, Netflix is the short answer. I mean, if you really want to get away – now you're saying cable. Now, if you mean actually want to watch over the air TV, that's a challenge. I've done it here. I've got an antenna that kind of looks like a big fan blade. It picks up HD signals, and I have 7 stations, and then combined with their second and third channels, maybe a total of about 15 – stations, but it's real iffy, and I don't know. You have to be pretty close to an HD signal. HD radio and TV, in some ways, is over the air, is really taking a step backwards in my view. But anyway.
Does your reception get bad when it rains or gets cloudy?
It doesn't seem to be affected. Well, I don't know, since I can't see the video. I recorded some things that I thought had great audio, and someone said the video was fuzzy. So, and I thought HD usually is pretty much all or nothing. It's either there and it's really good quality or it's not.
Yeah.
And when you bring in the PC into the factor, maybe there's RF interference or something else coming into play.
It's because of an analog signal is not digital in any way, right? So if it gets interrupted, you might see a little jump in the picture. Maybe the sound would be interrupted briefly. But given that HD is all digital, if that digital signal gets wiped out, then it has to wait till it can reconstruct that data before it can do anything with it, right?
Okay,
well, the way my wife describes it is it freezes, it's like a
right.
freeze frame.
Yeah, because it has to wait for it to catch up to a good quality signal before it can reconstruct that data it's getting off that signal. That's also why the range is probably not as good either, because if it's like you said, it's all or nothing pretty much.
Jana Jackson asks if one of you could explain what ARIA is.
Either of you guys want to take a crack at that?
Not me.
So ARIA is a group of web standards that browser makers are beginning to support that allow screen readers to get better information about what's going on a web page and allow web application developers to define zones that would be excluded from forms mode and other elements like that, defining landmarks where people can skip around, like the beginning of messages in Gmail, etc., etc. The support for ARIA right now is fragmented and not very consistent, so we haven't seen a lot of really good examples of how it can be used to make accessibility better, but I think in the next major version of most browsers, we'll see some better support for it.
Peter, isn't there still some definition going on with the standards, too? Like, there's some different coding standards that are being tossed about?
Yeah. ARIA, much like EPUB and some of the other standards out there, is still not finalized and has not been fully matured yet.
Okay. We're at the Sony Betamax / VHS stage, probably.
Oh, yes. Which standard will win? Which standard will prevail? Jess Smith asks, how do you do a fresh install of Microsoft.NET Framework when the install is corrupted? That question confuses me. I mean, I'd say re-download the installer. I don't know what you mean. Windows is corrupted?
Yeah.
Or what? I don't understand the question.
.NET uses the Windows installer technology, and it is possible that his install has gotten messed up. Jess, the best thing to do is go find the Windows installer cleanup tool, which is a Microsoft tool that they stopped offering, but you can still find it around some other places. That directly edits the Windows MSI database, and you need to be really careful when you remove things out of there. So you need to find your bad version of .NET and remove it, and then start the installer again after you reboot.
Could you not also try a repair? Sorry.
Or a restore point, I was thinking, but I don't know if that would work or not.
Windows install doesn't usually honor system restore points.
I wasn't sure. I've never tried it, so.
There is usually a repair option you could try first, where it'll kind of try to go back over itself, and it's kind of like reinstalling over top of itself and checking for errors. It doesn't always work, but might be safer before you go to more extreme methods.
Yeah, I want to stress again that tool can totally hose your entire Windows OS, so you need
absolutely.
To be...
Absolutely. I mean, you won't even boot in safe mode if you do it wrong.
Now, of course, so we have the benefit of Windows 7. We can actually reinstall, either try to fix it or just do a clean install, and we could do that Vista to 7 or even Windows 7 to a clean copy of Windows 7. But my question is, have anyone found a way to easily upgrade your own computer from XP to Windows 7 without sighted assistance? I know there's the AIK, the automatic...
Only with unattended installers, you know.
Yeah, unfortunately, unattended is the only way I can do it, and... What I like to do is, you always got to be prepared before you do any sort of thing like that. Make sure you get all your drivers, know what you're going to need. I use a USB audio dongle so that because your sound card may not work when it completes, therefore you can't get speech. So use something USB based that you can just plug in and it'll work right away. What I like to do is try it in VMware if at all possible. I really like playing with VMware because then you can try deploying it, see if it works as you think it should, and if it doesn't, go back and mess around with it some more and try again.
One comment I would add about getting speech is you want to have a non-DDI hooking screen reader like NVDA or System Access handy.
Yes.
So that something that will read your video even if it's not installed correctly, because if DDI hooks like WindowEyes or JAWS are not going to work at all until your display driver is properly working.
And this system administrator will not be sad to see those mirror drivers go.
Yeah, they're pretty bad. When I was doing work at the store, when I do work on a customer computer, I cannot use anything that does that because those also can tend to sometimes corrupt display drivers. And then they have to be reinstalled, and it's just a mess. It's not good. So
it
that's
makes
why
work,
I own
yeah.
System Access.
Yeah, let's see. We have a question here asking about what is the default boot order for Windows 64? Do I have to make changes? What they're trying to do is figure out how to use Casper in particular, one particular backup restore solution.
Is that a DVD-based one?
I think it will, because you could do a whole image. Or it's primarily designed for another hard drive, an external. I guess you would boot, create a USB drive, and boot from that to do your restoration.
That would be hardware dependent and would
yeah, that's
rely on
BIOS
BIOS
setting.
Most BIOS stuff that's more recent is configured to boot to USB devices that are plugged in first. That's not the case with every device out there, but a lot of the major stuff, HP and Dell, have started to do that.
Yeah. You can, unfortunately, the BIOS is one really lacking area in terms of accessibility, especially with like laptops. I don't really have an answer there, but OCR, you know, maybe an answer in some way.
Opticon.
Yeah, like I have the Sci recognizer, and that that tends to work. You know, you point the camera at the screen, take a picture of it. But even if you get a good picture, the problem that you'll run into is that
not knowing
you don't know what you're highlighting. So
hey, how about FaceTime and a sighted friend? How's that?
Well, that works. The other, if you have a desktop and your BIOS is text-based, and that unfortunately is also sort of iffy, I have something I use called a PC Weasel, which is a controller board that you... You can plug that thing in.
Joe Steinkamp asks how that compares to the KNFB reader.
It's the KNFB reader is more portable. The Sci Recognizer basically is a software package which then connects to a camera they supply you with, and then you have like it's a normal digital camera that you point at whatever, and then you press a button on your computer, like say the space bar or enter, and it will capture the image and then process it. So it's a little bit more configurable, per se, than the KNFB reader, but it's also a little bit more bulky and there's more to it. So
I have used the KNFB reader to read the computer screen before, and no, it's not always perfect, but it can oftentimes give you the information you need, at least the stuff that I've needed to this point. What you want to do, though, is turn your flash off on the KNFB reader, and you have better results on the computer screen.
Yeah, make sure your room is dark. I've found that if I'm trying to do that and there's a bunch of light behind me, it gives the camera trouble. So it's best if you can do it in a dark setting, at least on my setup. But I assume probably you're getting a lot of interference from the light in the image.
We have a question asking, how do you go into the Windows 7 start menu in all programs? It is different from XP. One of the things is up arrowing instead of down arrowing. Down arrowing, which you're probably used to in XP.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, you cannot use first letter navigation because the first thing you focus is the search box.
You can move off of the search box, and then you can.
And then use first letter, yeah.
Yeah.
But you do have to at least get in the all programs in focus, and you want a right arrow to open things, and pressing enter on stuff doesn't always open. You want to use left and right arrow to go back and forth between opening and closing things.
That's also correct, yeah.
And then your right, and this is interesting because you have your right, whatever they call it, the applications key or right click key or shift F10, and sometimes you get different results, different options, depending upon where you are in Windows 7 too.
I'm going to bring a Twitter question in here that I just happened to see from someone that I follow. Justin Eckes asks, what are the major differences switching from Windows XP to Windows 7 from a blindness perspective? And I think the biggest one is, at least from my perspective, definitely was the changed interface as far as the taskbar and the start menu.
Menu control panel. Control panel is just a nightmare.
Yeah, I take mine back to the classic view. the start menu, or rather the control panel, uses a bunch of links in the newer versions, and there's a bunch of subcategories, and it's I think it's designed to make it simpler for someone who doesn't know what they're doing, but if you're trying to find something specific, it can really be hard.
You can get lost in there. It's doable, but you can get lost in there pretty easily. I know finding wireless networks is a little more difficult.
What I would say in Windows 7, Windows 7, that search box is your friend. Use it. I mean, because it will take you to where you need to go.
You can type in there anything you want to find, including stuff in the control panel, any item really, not just documents or things like that, but anything on that computer, it'll search out and give you results.
Yeah, just remember, don't include the letter R. You go from XP, you're used to putting an R in front of things, and it doesn't work. So remember, no R needed, just type in a website or something, a file on your computer, music, whatever you're looking for, a feature of Windows, it's all there for you. Now, this is an interesting question asking about optimizing Facebook with IE9. They're having difficulties, and is there anything to improve the usability of IE9? Any default settings that should be changed?
What I would do for Facebook, I haven't upgraded to IE9 on all my computers yet, but I tell you, at least from the Facebook side, I use Facebook Mobile on my computer and on my phone. It's just easier, and I can do everything with it. It just cuts out all the junk that you really don't need. I've had a lot of success with it.
A lot of problems, a lot of the reason why I don't recommend people do that is because the mobile site is specifically configured for mobile browsers. So as Facebook continues to make adjustments to their mobile interface as they want to stop developing their touch site and all that, you're going to find increasingly that some things will stop working on the mobile site on desktop browsers. And so I hesitate to really suggest...
Including adding friends.
Yeah, I would say get used to the classic interface or the Facebook full interface as quickly as you can. And the other thing I would say about that is that now I have used IE8 and IE9 in the regular full Facebook interface, and I have not noticed one single difference.
There are some issues with certain screen readers and forms in IE9, and those are definitely being worked on. So, you know, that might be something that, you know, as you try to write comments or send messages or things like that, that person was encountering.
Another good question you're asking, which email applications are each of you using on Windows 7?
Well, I'm a Microsoft Outlook guy because I'm stuck with Exchange Server at work, so.
I use Microsoft Outlook as well, and I've got my work and personal email addresses all coming through that. Plus, it goes to my phone, so. A lot of syncing is great.
I just use the default Windows Live Mail. It seems to work okay. I used to use Outlook, but as I don't sync to anything of that nature anymore, it wasn't necessary to continue to use it.
Aren't there problems with corruption on Windows Live Mail? At least I've seen in the past.
Yeah, it's. I haven't personally, but like I know that there have been issues that were dealt with at work where essentially the person would lose their mail. We had tools that we could go in and recover it for them. I would hope they have all that addressed by now, but as for myself, I haven't had an issue.
And of course, we'll do the shameless plug for SamNet, which lets you look at all your email there and even add third-party accounts and all that good stuff. And there's a few different clients. I actually use something really old. I can't recommend it because it's not even supported anymore, called Courier. And there's things I like about it, like, you know, that has a .box file that I can transfer between machines and all the settings and everything is there. But it really doesn't have good HTML support, which you need these days. And, you know, some folks play with Thunderbird. It works a little bit better with certain screen readers than others. And but I still haven't found the ultimate, you know, I mean, Outlook, I agree, we use it. You know, it's there. Part of why I joined TechNet, it was cheaper to be a member of TechNet rather than outright buy Office, but you have to meet certain qualifications to do that. But anywho.
I haven't even seen Courier in years.
Yeah, they replaced it with another client, and it's not fully accessible. It's partially accessible, but...
Eudora.
Yeah, no, well, they may have, but there's something else they use, too. There's a new, I can't think of what it's called, but... So, yeah, Eudora's, it looks like Outlook and Windows Live, Eudora's doable? I know it's still out there. It's ad sponsored.
Last time I used it, it was okay, but...
Okay, so maybe Eudora.
It's been a while.
You might take a look at that. Jeff Bishop asks if you think it's safe for all users to be on Windows 64-bit in terms of compatibility. Now, this is one Richard and I disagree
sure.
on a little bit. I find
yeah.
some problems sometimes in 64-bit. There's times I wish I had 32. I found it to be more stable with certain
apps. Just install XP mode. I mean, there's not anything I can't do on 64-bit that I've found.
I would tend to say if you don't need to go to 64-bit, then don't worry about it, just because, you know, especially if you're running older programs. Now, some of your experiences might have been a bit different, but if you're running older programs, you know, you might run into some issues. At least that's what I thought until you said
don't even install. Microsoft encourages not even to install Office 64-bit unless you're running spreadsheets greater than 2 gig or whatever. So
exactly, and the same thing goes for the browser. I mean, don't use the 64-bit browser, you know, for Internet Explorer, because the 32-bit versions will work with lots more plugins, and it doesn't slow anything down. And you know, well, one of the things that I have begun doing over the last 6 to 9 months, and Rachel, you probably have run into this too, Corey. I've begun trying to replace some of my older programs, because You know, this is reality check time, folks. We don't like change, but we need to start trying to find tools that work for us, different tools that work for us, instead of using older programs that aren't even being developed anymore.
I agree.
Go ahead.
Basically, I was just going to say, like, 64-bit, the problem there, especially if you are still running older hardware, you may have issues there. A lot of older programs, especially programs that used to store their data in your program files folder instead of following Microsoft's guidelines, you're going to have real trouble with that because, you know, Microsoft now protects the program files folder. And so if the program stores, say, documents, I don't have a specific example in front of me right now, but if the program stores files that you need to access in its own folder, then you know, that concept is out of date now, and unfortunately will cause you a lot of headaches because now Microsoft wants you to put documents where documents are meant to go and so on.
But you had that
when
problem with 32-bit, too.
Older programs, what I meant by older programs, you know, if you're in an office setting, there could be some old proprietary things that your organization or agency uses, so you want to be really careful about that too, that you're not upgrading to something that they can't work with either.
Well, you would assume that if you're working somewhere that your IT department is handling that.
IT has their own agendas sometimes.
Well,
what are you saying about us?
Here's the rule of thumb when it comes to 64-bit. Don't install 64-bit operating system on something that you already have. If you get something OEM that has a 64-bit, fine, use it. But don't install 64-bit on something that you have that you know will run it just because you think it'll run it.
Well, I did. I mean, on my computer, because I had 8 gig of RAM, so I wanted to use all 8, not 4 minus the video card. Give me 3.5 or whatever.
Yeah. Most modern hardware you need 64-bit to take full advantage of, and despite everything that you might have heard to the contrary, 64-bit is the way things pretty much are going. Even a lot of your phones and iPad and things like that these days are going 64-bit. So that's the way it's going to be. So people are just going to have to get used to it. Michael, we're ready to announce the winner.
Yeah, if you have it, sure.
All right. So tonight's lucky winner of a free DocuScan Plus license is Rodney Edgar.
All right. Well, congratulations, Rodney. He was the 21st person to submit his question. And again, it's a $299 value. And by the way, we haven't mentioned it, but we did. We reset all 7-day evaluations at DocuScanPlus.com. So if you ever tried it before, don't feel like you had enough time to go in and play with it, all of them have been reset. Or if you haven't done so yet, either way, go to DocuScan.plus.com. You get another 7 days to put it through its paces via Windows or the Mac, see what it's made of, see what you can do, scan some paper documents, convert some PDFs, play around with the audio capabilities, all of that. Again, 7 days, all accounts, all trials are reset, so you got another 7 days over at DocuScanPlus.com. And congratulations to Rodney for that. See, we have a question asking about converting Windows Live Mail to Outlook 2010. Is there a way to import all your contacts and messages?
Yep, Outlook 2010 has, the first time you start it up, should ask you about importing, and Windows Live Mail should be in the list.
You can also just go to the menu, and in there it'll have an import option if you have gotten past that as well.
Now, what about if you need to reinstall Windows and you want to back up the files, the Outlook that has all your data in it?
Okay, how I would do that, and I have to do this routinely for customers if they need to reinstall. If they're using Windows Live Mail or, you know, back in the old days, Outlook Express, which, you know, they basically work under the same concept. Each email is placed in its own little file, which is placed in a folder, which is in your user subfolder. And if you go into the options and go over to advanced, there is actually a path in there. You can change it, but you can also view it. And you can just go in there and see where it's putting those files, and then just navigate there and copy them to some other media. And then just, you know, when you're done later, create your account, go find this, where it's placing them then, and then just overwrite those files with the new ones. That works. If in the case of Outlook, Outlook uses its database format, which is much nicer because it's
good,
just one
PST.
File.
Yep.
Yeah. And you can just copy that to anything you want and then bring it back in when you're done. I have to do it for myself if I reinstall or anything like that. So,
and every source, everything but your password, right? So just make sure you remember your password and you're good to go.
That's correct.
I really admire all you PC technicians and tech support people that, that live out in the wild of not organized IT land. We've got all of our people saving stuff to server shares, and you know, you guys live in the wild world.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You have no idea what you see on some people's computers.
Keep life interesting.
That's one of the things that we hope that cloud computing or saving stuff to the internet will do for us eventually. For instance, thanks to my old buddy Pete Bosley over there, I just saved all my contacts up to Google. So I've got a little CSV file that I just update once in a while, and so no matter where I am, unless Google dies tomorrow, I got my contacts.
Yeah, I have everything feeding to my Gmail. Then I can get it on my iPhone. I can get it on my computer, on my other computer. It's all, you know, using IMAP. Dropbox is another lovely tool.
Oh, yes.
Because if you got any important documents, for example, if I bought a program and I don't want to lose the registration information, you know, it's in my email, sure, but I also just copy it over to Dropbox. You get 2 free gigabytes of storage, which is most definitely enough for most people's documents. And you just throw it up there, and you know, I don't know how it could be much safer. I don't know about privacy, but definitely in terms of losing it, it's not very likely to happen. So,
man, you can stay under 2 gigs. I got about 130 gigs on Dropbox.
Well, I'm just talking about text documents, but
yeah, and there's a new service I read about the other day called Walla, W-U-A-L-A. We'll have to see if that app's accessible, and it's got some better prices for data storage, so we'll have to see if it's usable. And although they said it offered greater flexibility as far as the directories and things you back up, however, they didn't think in one sense it was as easy or as intuitive as Dropbox is. But yes, Dropbox has changed their terms of service. Go ahead,
Rachel. I'll just throw this one out there, too. I have not used it personally, but I've heard a lot of good comments about it. Carbonite is another good one to back up to.
Yeah, I was just talking with someone about that, but he wasn't sure if he was going to renew it because he said you have to go through a lot of steps. And I think a lot of people want to be able to make, you know, point to certain directories and say just back up everything and kind of want to get to a set it and forget it where they don't have to each time, every day, go in and making sure that it's actually backed up. Everything.
And as far as the upload speeds, I understand Mozy and Carbonite are both very slow as far as their ability to, how quickly they actually back things up.
Most people's residential connections are so slow that anything is going to be kind of slow.
Yeah, and what happens when they start doing data caps and you want to back up 50, 100 gig, you know, files and, you only get 150 this month and you've exceeded it, we're going to charge you for backing up your data. Something
that
to think about.
That is a concern. Network attached storage, that would be my answer to that one.
Yeah, of course you do want something.
This is gonna label me forever as a geek, but I actually have a network attached storage device, and then I have a tape drive that I occasionally write a tape of my data and take it to my office and lock it in a safe.
I was gonna say a safety deposit box. I know people who actually back up their stuff on DVDs and actually put them in safety deposit boxes.
Good old USB drives is what I end up using.
Yeah, I don't know what the failure rate or the life expectancy of those is, but yeah, at least doing something and getting off the premises, a tornado or all the flooding we've had here in the Midwest. I mean, you've got to be thinking, you know, that something could get in and lose your valuables.
Really, the ultimate you want is probably 3 different types of backup if you're really concerned. You know, have a backup somewhere on the net, have a USB drive possibly, and then something on a different location, you know, possibly CDs. But CDs and DVDs would be so many to back up everything. But ultimately, you want probably 3 different mediums of backup in order to keep yourself safe.
And definitely something off-site, you know, because, I mean, your house burns, you tornado, flood, I mean, something off-site. A backup is – an on-site backup is not a backup.
You know, if it's good for businesses, it's probably good for consumers. You know, I'll tell you what we do. We run a backup every night, and then every Friday, a guy in an armored truck shows up and picks up a backup for us and takes it off-site and stores it in the vault somewhere.
There you go.
Another thing I'd like to put forward, if I may, is a utility I'd recommend.
Yeah, I was just ready to go there. I ask about software specifically for backing up, either making images to restore or at least something to back up all the important directories that you want. What would you
like to mention? This addresses a different concern. It's in terms of security. And I don't know if anyone's played with it, but has anyone tried out TrueCrypt? It's open source. It seems to be really good. I've been using it. You can create encrypted thumb drives. You can encrypt whole hard drives, even including the operating system. And apparently, according to benchmarks, the operating systems run faster with them encrypted as without. Not sure why. Nobody seems to have an answer. But according to another podcast I referenced, that they ran a bunch of tests and they determined it's actually faster when you encrypt your drive.
Doesn't encryption prevent indexing? Maybe it's preventing some indexing from happening, and that probably speeds things up.
No, what he's talking about is whole disk encryption to encrypt as a whole disk encryption mode. And Corey, what that's probably referring to is some of the new Core i7 and Sandy Bridge processors have a dedicated processing mode for handling AES 256-bit encryption, which is what the TrueCrypt program uses. I strongly doubt that it's actually faster. I could believe it being about the same.
Yeah, I'm not sure, really. They did defrag tests, and they claimed apparently it was faster. But in any case, even if you don't want to encrypt your whole drive, you can create a single file, which is it shows up in your Windows Explorer as a drive by itself, and you can just drag and drop stuff onto that, eject it, and then you just back that up and... You know, it's encrypted at 256-bit or whatever. There's a whole bunch of encryption schemes you can choose. And so,
but pick 256-bit A's.
But, you know, if you're going to be putting stuff on the internet, on a cloud, that's one thing I'd suggest. If it's sensitive data, you might want to encrypt it.
So none of you use specific imaging software. I mean, that's just something I'm adamant about, and I really haven't found – well, I think I finally found a good solution for my Windows 64, but I used to use TrueImage, but I had to use a slightly older version because of accessibility, and it requires a lot of clicking around the screen using mouse navigation. Paragon, this 2011, is looking like a very nice suite of backup. I've used the Norton Ghost 15 or whatever number it is, but I found it slowed down my system to a point that I didn't want to live with the... I mean, it really slowed it down.
We've used Paragon. Paragon seems to be good, but again, the only problem with the imaging and such is you will run into a bit more of accessibility factors if you need to restore it. Because, you know, the image has its own software, which you then boot up and then run to restore the drive, and you may need assistance with that or need to memorize some things. So that's one concern, but definitely I've played around with Paragon software.
Does Paragon...
I've never been a big fan of imaging, Michael. If my system gets that messed up, bringing back an image really isn't going to help me, so I'm just going to start over.
Oh, I live by it. I swear by it. I mean, I can roll back, you know, a couple weeks when everything was good. Although you're right, you do at some point get to a point of, yeah, you fixed a few current problems, but it's not a pristine image of Windows if such a thing exists. But it takes me over 4 hours, and that's if I really hustle just to – I have so many apps – so many pieces of software. Don't sue me, I said app. Okay, so many pieces of software that I use and are configured a certain way that it really takes me,
there's
a whole day. There's an app for that. You know, so I'm a fan of imaging. It's not for everyone, but it certainly beats the heck out of rebuilding everything from scratch and going digging up all your software.
Well, if nothing else, make an image right after you have fixed everything or right when you first install everything, and at least you have that image with all your software, apps, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And you at least have that to go on that'll at least give you a little bit of a head start.
Right. And what I do is I put my email and all my important files on a different partition. So when I restore C, I don't lose email. I don't lose any of my music software. And so C for me is strictly my installed software and settings. That's all my C partition is. So that's
what I do too, definitely.
True geeks here, folks, talking to you. Take it from the geeks. Anyway, we're down to our final 2 minutes or so, so let me mention a couple things here. First of all, those of you who could not join us live listening to the archive, if you hear this before the end of May 11, you have a chance to win a $100 Cerotech gift card. All you have to do is send us an email with your name, phone number, and your email address, and send that over to resources@cerotalk.com. That's resources@cerotalk.com, the way you can communicate with us for all podcasts and tech chats, and we will draw a winner on Thursday 12th and announce it here on Tech Chat 101. And by the way, Tech Chat 101 will be another show on gaming. We will be speaking live with the developer of Stem Stumper, and we should have a couple other pre-recorded interviews and hopefully some other gaming folks. And one of the true aficionados of blind gaming, Michael Fair, will be joining me and co-hosting. So we had such a great response to the last Tech Chat on gaming. We're going to do that again. And So very, very excited. I really enjoyed this tech chat. This is one of my favorites. I really like just sharing information, and hopefully we can do these more often if our guests are willing to come back in the future. And most importantly, if you, the audience, like these type of events, it's very important to hear what you like, what you don't like, so we know where to direct our energies to give you the best possible information. So it makes a difference.
Let's get a big round of applause for all of the guests and everybody that's been on these tech chats in the past 100 tech chats.
That's right, 100. We've had a number of people. I went and listened to some of my old ones when I used to just do like lectures, like I was up front in class, and then someone said, boring. Some were good and some really sucked. So it's an evolution process. But yes, thank all of you this evening and all folks that have been here throughout the 100 events and the podcasts as well. It's all appreciated. We certainly feel we're doing something right. We won the Best Podcast Award in 2010, and we take that seriously and want to keep making the shows better, but it requires input from you. Resources at CeroTalk.com and calling us on the Blab line. Yes, the well-forgotten Blab line, 866-997-BLAB, 866-997-2522. Again, we thank you, Rachel Schroeder, Corey Martin, Mr. Richard Wells, and Pete Bosley, all for your areas of expertise this evening.
Thanks for having us.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, folks, yes. Join us next week. We'll do Tech Chat 101 on gaming and, of course, the podcast rolling out around May 9th with the latest AT news and some reviews of some more iOS keyboards and MLB At-Bat 2011. Maybe you've been needing some help on how to use that to listen to baseball games. You can get all that coming up in future Cero Talk events. So if you like, join us in the tech room, and we'll continue discussions there about anything that's on your mind. And until we meet again, folks, let us stay connected and stay directed.
This concludes another CeroTalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of CeroTech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.
Comments on CeroTalk Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent CeroTech Corporation, its staff, management, third-party resellers, or sponsors.